This is Regionally Speaking from Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. That means we're going to talk to reporters from local media about the stories they've put out in print and online. And we have with us Amy LaValle, who is the editor of the Chesterton Tribune, to kick off the program today. Amy, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
I know some of the stories that you've had out in the recent editions and the ones coming up, too, with the Chesterton Tribune deal with some thoughts first from local veterans about the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And we know now, too, that there have been troops that have died and wounded in the attack on the airport at Kabul or just outside the airport. Tell us, though, about the information that you got together in talking with veterans here in the region about the overall thoughts on withdrawal from Afghanistan.
I spoke with two people for the story that ran Tuesday. There was a third veteran who reached out to me who didn't feel comfortable speaking publicly at this juncture.
Mm-hmm.
But the main sense that I got, was there was just heartbreaking that this wasn't the way they wanted to see it happen. It was going to have to happen inevitably, that the United States would have to leave. We couldn't stay there forever. And 20 years had already seemed like forever. But there was just sort of a sense of, as one of the veterans talked, it was like watching a house burn down, And the other veteran I spoke with said that, the United States had standards that were followed while the troops were there, and yet none of those standards seem to be being upheld as they withdrew. And it's hard to say. I talked to them a week ago when really this was just a few days old, and it's still very fresh, obviously. And I don't know that anyone knows what the answers would have been, but it seemed that the people I talked to were just devastated. They were proud of the time they had served. They had put their lives on the line. They had come to know the people in Afghanistan. And it just seemed like a gut punch to watch this happen with so much chaos and fear and everything else.
I suppose now that we're obviously going to have another story or two come out of this as things develop, certainly with the latest developments that have come up even today over in Afghanistan. But I'm sure there'll be a number of people that will find out more and they'll react more to what's happening on the daily basis as the news seems to change from overseas. Do you think that there'll be probably more reaction from folks there in the Chesterton area about it?
Think so. And like I said, the one veteran who I spoke with who wasn't comfortable speaking on the record for a story, because it really was just a few days, wanted to get his thoughts together. And I said, look, if and when you're ready, write a guest commentary.
Mm-hmm.
You're a local person. You served over there. You have a unique perspective. We'd love to hear it.
That's
so
great.
It's possible that maybe in a couple weeks or whatever. And certainly, as things transpire, I can circle back to the veterans I spoke with or other veterans in the area. So we'll see. I don't know how things will transpire going forward, but you just hope that, that it goes as best as can be hoped at this point.
We're talking with Amy LaValle, who's the editor of the Chesterton Tribune, about stories that are in print coming out. In fact, in the paper today, Thursday, you have some stories that they'll be looking forward to. Let's talk about some of those, please. First off, you have a story that's coming out here concerning the latest on the securities fraud case, which apparently has been going on for quite some time. Tell us more about that, please.
That's Donald M. Johnson. He was first charged 7 years ago with 17, I don't have the figures directly in front of me, but it was like 17 counts of securities fraud with allegations involving roughly half a dozen or so people. A year later, there was another alleged victim added with some additional charges. And for an assortment of reasons, the case has just stalled and stalled and stalled. He was previously a realtor, and as I note in my story, and as the Chesterton Tribune has reported previously, he lost his real estate license with the state. He was put on probation and given the opportunity to pay a fine, and he never paid the fine, so he lost his license permanently. And when I kind of did a tally of the amount of money that all these alleged victims lost, it's well over $800,000.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. It's been a long time. I talked to one of the victims who alleges he lost $300,000. You know, in the charging documents, there were people who had handed over their retirement or the trust from a deceased spouse and those kinds of things in a land deal that was supposed to be taking place in Tennessee to flip local houses that were promised high returns. Maybe they get some returns initially and then they would dwindle and stop. According to the allegations, he was never licensed to sell securities and was selling unregistered securities through this. Last month, the Indiana Appellate Court said that they would consider taking a look at the case. They'd previously turned it down, but this time they said they would take a look. His attorney is making, you know, 2 points. One is that some of these charges are so old they're beyond the statute of limitations.
Right.
Too old to go forward. And the second point is that he was never actually selling securities, that the charges are baseless because that's not what he was doing. Mm. I did not speak with Mr. Johnson. His attorney did not avail him to me, but I did speak with one of his attorneys who said that, you know, there was an economic downturn. His clients believed they had been bilked, but really it was the economy. And I mean, the case is gone. He changed attorneys a number of times. There was a change in prosecutors in Porter County. And Gary Gurman, the current prosecutor, had to step away from the case and hand it over to Lake County because of a conflict of interest early on. And it was assigned to Judge Bradford. He retired. Judge Fish took over in Porter Superior Court. He recused himself and it went to Judge Clymer. It's being handled by the Lake County prosecutor. There was a pandemic. The folks at the Lake County prosecutor's office said that the initial deputy prosecutor they put on the case was called into military service for a year, so they had to put somebody new on the case. It's just been again and again and again. And right now it's kind of up to the appellate court and what they decide to do if they say, look, you know, these charges can't stand as they are, or you can't go forward with all these charges. Mr. Johnson had tried previously to reach out to the appellate court for the same modification, and the appellate court turned him down and sent it back to state court. So I don't know at this point what will happen going forward. I know there's a lot of people who would like to see this resolved. One way or another, would like to find out if they're ever going to get their money back, if they are indeed entitled to it. So we'll see.
Well, that's the way some of these cases handle, I guess. And certainly it means it's going to be another interesting story in the Chesterton Tribune when some resolution does come about here, too. Amy,
yeah,
one of... Amy, you also had an opportunity to get some good news in, besides some serious things. And one of the good news stories certainly is coming out is about the demonstration day over at MAC. Tell us how the demonstration day went, since they spend a lot of time being concerned and training first responders.
You know, that was a lot of fun. It was unbelievably hot out. And you had, you know, firefighters wearing heavy gear, which is their job, but it was certainly very warm for everybody. But, you know, the MAC is the Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative, as it's fully called there, on Valparaiso Southeast Side, is a terrific facility. It's grown over the years. They do so much training for all of the police and fire in this area and beyond. And local departments are also involved in assisting with that training. And I just thought it was a great chance to go out there. Because I work for the Chesterton Tribune, I focused my story on the Burns Harbor Fire and EMS and the Chesterton Fire Department, because those were, you know, my local peeps, if you will, and the kinds of demonstrations they were doing. But it was just a lot of fun. People were having a good time. It was interactive. It was great to see what they did and for people to learn more about that facility.
I know that's the thing that I know that they appreciated, not only in showing off what the first responders learned to do and how well they learned to do it there at the facility in their classes, but they have a chance to show the public. And they don't do that every day, I understand. It's only a few times a year, even if that often, that they're able to invite the public to come into the facilities and check the place out, see how they train people, especially the firefighters and police officers. They go through the certain situations that they may face in real life on the job. They get to train about it. So at least they're not totally stumped when they get a phone call or some email message saying that they've got something to check out.
Right, right. It's just it's immeasurable value for the community. And when I was talking to the leaders from Chesterton Fire and Burns Harbor, they said, you know, in the past, before that, to get their training, they'd have to go to a bunch of different area departments. Maybe you would do, you know, this training in this department because they have that, but then the next training would take place over here. And it's all in one place now. And it's multiple agencies. They can work together on things. It's just a wonderful, wonderful place.
Now, Amy, we haven't had an opportunity until now to talk with you since you made the transition over from being with the Post Tribune to becoming the editor of the Chesterton Tribune. How has the transition been coming along from the previous owners of the newspaper to Don Hurd's organization? Since he has a number of newspapers under his operation, how's the operation so far at the Chesterton Tribune been going?
Yes, I think it's been going really well. I mean, for me, it's been a personal adjustment to go from working as a reporter for a daily newspaper to being editor of a twice-weekly paper.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to be like, oh, let's put this on the front page, or how's that story coming? Or, you know, obviously, I'm still writing my stories, too, and the chance to work with some, you know, very talented freelancers. We recently brought on a phenomenal sports editor, and that's made a huge difference, especially with football and other high school sports starting up this fall.
Oh, yes.
The main question that I get on a regular basis is the paper online?
Right.
Not yet. We will be soon. I'm not ready to publicly announce details because I need to make sure everything's in place and check with Don Hurd or find out when he'll be ready to announce publicly. But for those of you who've asked, who've messaged us on Facebook or emailed us or called or whatever, come up to me in public and be like, is the paper online? No, but it will be soon. And that will be a huge benefit for the community and for our readers and everybody else. So we're looking forward to that here very soon.
I know that you do take the opportunity to, as you have even recently, to give some clues as to what's in the paper on the Facebook page, on the Chesterton Tribune Facebook page, which is nice. Yeah. At least you know something's ahead, something worth getting the newspaper to actually see. So that's good to see that. So I'm sure that's probably gotten even more people curious as to when the newspaper is going to go online.
Hopefully, yeah. And we get a lot of people who post on the Facebook page. Like, I'll post like I did today or, mm-hmm. you know, usually Tuesdays and Thursdays. Sometimes on late Friday night or early Saturday morning, we post information about Friday night's football game and say, hey, check out Tuesday's paper because we come out Tuesday and Thursday. But, yeah, hopefully that's generating more interest. It's letting people know the paper is back because it did close for a few months. And a lot of people are like, oh, I didn't know it was back. You know, it's full color now. It's twice a week instead of daily, but it's got a different format
mm-hmm.
and a full focus on community news. So hopefully we'll extend our reach even further when we're online.
That's true. Now, you mentioned that it'll be coming online soon, but in the meantime, how can people get the Chesterton Tribune?
Well, you can stop by our office, which is on South Calumet in Chesterton. We're about a block south of the previous office.
Mm-hmm.
It's also available at about 24 or 25 or so local merchants. And I put those on our Facebook page, and I can again. They include the Ace Hardware, Jewel Osco, Strack and Van Til, Family Express, I think by Strax. I can't run through them all because I'll forget.
Well, that's good. It's
but,
a way to let people know that it's
available.
Out there.
And you can get a subscription and have it delivered by mail. People can call our office or email us and set up to get the newspaper that way.
Well, Amy LaValle, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the things that are coming up in the next edition soon, like today, with the Chesterton Tribune. And we appreciate finding out about how the newspaper's doing these days, too. And we hope to have you back on again to talk about the stories of that happened in Chesterton and vicinity as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's talk to Carol Carlson, who's a reporter for the Post Tribune, about the stories she's had out in print and online, most of them dealing with the school districts here in the region. And Carol, thank you for being back with us here.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's go first on the many interesting stories that are coming up with dealing with the pandemic and getting back to school here in Northwest Indiana. In particular, your story about the Lake Central School Board. They had a recent school board meeting, and, of course, the always important issue of whether youngsters have to, and teachers, for that matter, too, have to wear masks in the classroom. But it's led to a lot of display of complaints, we understand.
Yeah, school boards across the country really are finding themselves on the front lines of, COVID mask, anti-masking anger. And Lake Central was no exception. They, at the beginning of the year, put in a mask mandate for kids in their school system, which is the largest in Northwest Indiana. And at the most recent school board member meeting, some parents and others in the community showed up to disagree with that mandate.
As it turned out, I know the school board had put out the mandate, and now it's up to the citizens to have something to say about it. I understand that they had a nice demonstration outside the school board meeting itself, or out in the parking lot.
Yeah, the folks who opposed the mandate put together a rally that drew, I want to say 100 people. Mm-hmm. Notably, though, there was a state lawmaker, Hal Slager, from Schererville, and the chairman of the Lake County Republican Party, Dan Dernal. And they both voiced their opposition to the mandate.
As it turned out, even with the people who are complaining about masks and trying to get the school board to change its mind, that didn't apparently sway their decision, did it?
No, it did not. They held firm, which I don't know. I wouldn't say that was surprising, but it might have surprised the anti-mask contingent that maybe expected them to bring it back a little bit.
I know you mentioned in your story when it came up to the Lake Central School Board meeting that they had an opportunity to get some latest information from IU Northwest professor Micah Pollack. He has that page out there on his Twitter feed to give the latest statistics and other observations. And you mentioned some of that information in there. Will you tell us a little about what you learned from Professor Pollack concerning the latest involving COVID-19 here?
Yeah, he's been doing some weekly updates. The State Board of Health updates school totals every Monday, I believe it is, and he's been tracking that and doing a great job. He mentioned the case numbers at some of our school districts, and Crown Point is seeing an increasing number of cases. They're among the districts that masks are optional, and there were also a number of concerning cases at Lake Central where masks are enforced. Other districts, Gary, Hammond, in East Chicago, all have mask mandates as well.
Mm-hmm. What seem to be the concerns that you mentioned and was put in some of Professor Pollack's information, but I'm sure there's concern about not only the COVID-19 infection rate among youngsters and the possibility that it could increase with the Delta variant out there, but I guess it was also mentioning about whether employers should get involved here. And you mentioned some information that was in the ADA. Will you tell us more about that?
He talked about the necessity for vaccinations, and especially in light of the fact that kids under 12, of course, aren't eligible to be vaccinated at this point, and they would be the most vulnerable to possibly getting a positive case.
Mm-hmm. One of the other stories you had out there in print and online from another school district, this time it's from the Gary Community Schools, talks about not only the pushback that the school board, or the school officials, I should say, have had from critics about the situation involving youngsters and whether they have mask mandates, which the Gary Community School Corporation does have in place. Tell us more about the information you got from the story and about, the protesters themselves that were complaining.
Well, Gary has been pretty forthright from the beginning of the pandemic with its mask mandate, and they're being extremely careful there. And not just students and staff, but any visitors who enter the school for any reason. They're actually limiting visitors into the school. There was a protest last week at Gary Westside. Is that the one you're referring to?
Yes.
That had nothing to do with mask mandates.
That was actually related
to education issues.
They were more concerned, I guess, about the administration of the school district, I guess, rather than about the pandemic.
They're having major issues, like many districts are, but Gary is probably more acute with busing. And they contract with a company called Illinois Central that provides bus service for the district. And the Illinois Central company is having trouble finding drivers. Mm-hmm. So that has limited the routes that they can take, and parents are very angry about that. And obviously their kids starting school and there's no bus to take them to school. I talked to one parent who takes her own child as well as a couple other kids from the west side of Gary to the Gary Middle School, which is in the Miller section of Gary, just because their bus isn't running yet. And I spoke to her this week, and they are on remote learning this week because Gary Middle School and Bailey Middle School don't have air conditioning.
Mm.
That's another complaint that the parents had lodged. The school district says that they ordered air conditioning parts for these schools back in March, but because of the supply problem that they're just now receiving the parts, and we are told that they are to be installed this week. So maybe, hopefully, those schools can start operating with air conditioning next week and the kids can return to the school.
I know that you mentioned in your story about the questions that the citizens had here about the administration, in particular there at Westside Leadership Academy, that the parents were concerned that some of the advisory board members, which used to be school board members, but they're now, because of the change in the management with the school district, are just advisory board members, were not real happy about the complaints, tried to get some questions answered, and it turned out to be a little confrontation there. Tell us, as part of your story, what that was all about.
Well, what I was told is there was a fight at Westside, an altercation, and I was told by a school official that it was quickly tamped down. They did go on what she called a soft lockdown for about 15 or 20 minutes, securing all the kids in their classrooms. And a text went out to the school board advisory president, Robert Buggs, about the fight, and he was concerned and wanted to check it out himself. So he and another school advisory board member, James Piggy, went to Westside. And there's a couple entrances. The main entrance is on the north side, and that's the one students and visitors enter. Then there's also an entrance on the west side that is used by the school administration officials. They're headquartered there as well. So he went in the west side where administration officials are and proceeded to go on into the school. And the school requires you to go in the main school office and sign in. So they know you're there, and I believe you have to show an identification. And he didn't do that. That's what I was told. And the district manager went out to tell him to do that, and he disagreed with her. And one thing led to another, and he ended up being handcuffed and removed from the building.
I don't know why he would think that he would get in and not report to the office. I mean, how many decades have we all gone to schools and wanted to talk to somebody and said, well, you've got to go to the office and check in? You know, what did Mr. Buggs seem to think that he was any different?
That.
Well, is there anything, by the way, is there anything new in that situation? Are we still in that situation at the moment?
He's still insisting that he did not use any kind of profanity.
No, no,
and
no.
things like that.
Well, we know that's going to be another story that'll end up coming up eventually, too. And Carol, thank you for reviewing the stories you've had out there in print and online on the Post Tribune. Thank you very much for being with
thank
us today.
You, Chris.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Talking with Northwest Indiana Times business reporter Joseph Pete. Joe, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I want to cover here one of the update stories from your business file where you talk about businesses opening and closing as they happen. But let's go first with some sad news from Indiana Harbor, from the steel mill. We understand a contractor lost his life. Will you fill us in more about that first?
Oh, absolutely. It's a very unfortunate incident. You know, often the deaths at the mills are industrial accidents. That was not the case in this instance. The contractor was killed. It was an iron worker with a local union. He was killed in a parking lot. He was killed in a parking lot at the steel mill in East Chicago, the former Inland and LTV mill. He was hit with a pickup truck and killed. They employ literally hundreds of contractors usually at any given time to work on various maintenance and construction projects at these mills. Contractors, you know, they're not there, the individual contractor is there 365, like a steel worker, or, you know, not literally 365, but year round, but they could be there for working months at a time on a project. And, he was unfortunately killed in a vehicle accident at the mill. We had another death at Gary Works with Lucas Asher. It turned out to be a 40-year-old Fordish resident at the Chicago mill. Ryan Briney, unfortunately, he had been killed. Police are investigating the incident. And then the Lucas Asher, a 34-year-old Valparaiso resident, had died of a medical incident at Gary Works. Now, that was also medical. There was nothing... no industrial accident involved there, but steel mills are one of the deadliest, jobs in America. As you can see if you go to any of the union locals, and, you know, they have the walls of all the fallen, brothers and sisters who have died over the years. Mm-hmm. It's gotten considerably more safe in recent years, but it's still, you know, very, very dangerous work with, you're dealing with steel coils that can weigh more than a car. You're dealing with extreme heat. Great heights, all kinds of heavy equipment, semi-trucks, trains rumbling in and out at all times. It can be very dangerous. And, you know, this happened to be a vehicle accident, but the hazards are just immense. They put in a lot of technology, but there's only a degree to which you can mitigate, how safe you make these mills.
And I know we go now from... The industrial mishaps that can happen around steel mills and the like to the latest high-tech incidents, and we're talking in particular here about ransomware attacks. There have been a number of ransomware attacks reported in Indiana, and I guess your story talks about one of them that affected a region medical office.
Oh, absolutely. CarePoint ENT, it's based out of Maryville, but they also have offices, and they have a few offices throughout northwest Indiana. But their information was unfortunately compromised in a ransomware attack. It's become more and more common. You have these hackers operating internationally where they will send sort of phishing emails to places, you know, where they can be very convincing, and it's, kind of tricking people to click here. They can make it look, like it's from human resources or, someone people know and trust, or it's an online order or UPS shipments, or, click here to get a refund on your Amazon, or, they have various tactics they deploy, but they've become very sophisticated and effective at kind of deceiving people. But the CarePoint, the ear, nose, and throat doctor's office notified all the affected patients after all of its files were encrypted on its computer systems about a month ago. Basically, they'll encrypt a computer system and then demand that, like, a ransom be paid. And people will contact the FBI and so forth. They've hit up some pretty big companies, including, like, Strack and Van Til. It's a big issue, nationally. But they'll hit up, they'll freeze all the company's files. They'll make it impossible for them to access their own computers and basically demand a ransom in exchange to free up their computers. I've been told by local business executives, too, considering the highly illegal nature of it, some of these places are very actually professional. Like, they'll have a call center where you can call to make payments and, know, things of that nature. But they operate, like, you know, all over the world, out of Eastern Europe, Russia, so on and so forth. But the CarePoint had notified all the affected patients that there's the possibility, you know, some of their personal information could have been compromised, names, addresses, social security numbers, dates of birth, medical insurance information, possibly health information, that sort of thing. Usually the hackers are not really interested in private information in cases like this. It's more of, you know, they're just trying to lock, they're trying to get paid to unlock the computer system. But it's impossible to tell for sure when the, you know, the cybersecurity has been compromised. But this is something a lot of companies throughout Northwest Indiana have been investing more heavily in this. You have some companies locally like SimCorp out of Maryville where they specialize in, you know, protecting companies from this. But it's definitely a rising concern and more routine cost of doing business and trying to prevent, you know, attacks like this from taking place because we're, and, you know, everything from, you know, people are glued to their phones all the time, but even when you're driving a car nowadays, like, computers have become so much more integrated in everything we do, even if it's, like, you know, lane assist or something like that. It's just, we definitely live in a more, I mean, stuff like the Internet of Things maybe hasn't taken off as much as people had, some of the futurists had expected, but computers are just more and more defining our everyday lives.
We're talking with Joseph Pete, who's the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about his stories and that are out there in print and online. And one of the latest stories out there gives us an update on how the unemployment situation happens to be in Northwest Indiana. I guess the latest figures from July came out from the state. Fill us in how Northwest Indiana communities and the counties have been showing up.
Yes, unemployment in Indiana was 4.1% again last year. That's close to what economists could describe as like full employment. You know, you can think what you want about that concept, but generally a lot of economists tend to believe that, you know, there's naturally going to be around a 4% unemployment at any given time, just because you'll have people who are like in between jobs, people who are, you know, moving to a new city, or people who are, you know, long-term unemployed for whatever reason. But the belief among many economists is that, you know, you can kind of peak out. You know, it obviously can go lower, but the natural, the so quote unquote natural like unemployment rate is around, you know, 4% if an economy is humming along and providing, you know, enough jobs for anybody statewide. We're at around that, you know, even after it spiked significantly during kind of the depths of the pandemic last year, at least from the economic point of view, and a lot of stuff was, you know, still shut down or highly restricted or that kind of thing. But in Northwest Indiana, we continue to persistently have higher than average employment in the state. That's due in part to, you know, we have a very heavily industrial area here. A lot of our communities were originally built as company towns. You know, Gary, Chicago were built around steel mills. Hammond was built around a meat packing plant, Whiting around the refinery. You know, a lot of this area is just heavily dependent on industry, particularly heavy industry that tends to be boom or bust. Like, they're making record profits at the steel mills right now, but it's not that far away from a couple years ago. And they're losing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars every quarter. So it's real feast or famine, real cyclical, you know, either it's good times or it's bad times, and there isn't a lot of in-between. However, that being said, The unemployment rate is it's among the highest in the state in Northwest Indiana. Lake County has the highest jobless rate in the entire state. LaPorte County is third, and Porter County, which normally has lower unemployment because a lot of it for various reasons, but you know it's got a lot of, you know, with the Duneland area and Valpo and the Toro, there's a lot in the South Shore line. A lot of it is kind of a bedroom community. You have a lot of professionals working jobs in, you know, Chicago and that kind of thing. But they're still 10th in the state in unemployment this past month. It's as high as 8% in Lake County. It's still significantly high in some of the North Lake County cities. In particular, in Gary and East Chicago, it's still 15% in Gary, 12.8% in East Chicago. Hammond, it's close to 10% still. And then in it's lowest in the area. In Valpo, it's only about 4%. Crown Point, 4.7. Cherryville, 4.8. So you see a dichotomy between, you know, the suburban areas and the cities with, you know, appreciably lower unemployment rates in some of the suburban areas. But it did tick down across most of Northwest Indiana last month, but slightly. It fell to about 6.9% in the Gary metropolitan area in July. It was down only about 0.1% from the previous month. But almost all of that was declines in South Lake County, Porter and LaPorte counties, because you actually saw the unemployment tick up in it ticked up in Gary, it ticked up in East Chicago, it ticked up in Maryville, it ticked up in it went up a little bit in Hammond. So you have a lot of the urban areas are continuing to struggle as we recover from the pandemic. We had Kokomo had finally surpassed Lake County for the highest jobless rate in the state. It's pretty similar, actually, to Lake County. It's a very blue-collar, working-class, you know, manufacturing town. But Lake County went and took the top spot back from them this past month. Kind of an ignominious honor, but, you know, because we tend to have higher unemployment here than they do not only nationally, but also the state of Indiana and the Chicago metropolitan area. It's just the persistent, you know, persistent issue we have here. Yeah. But things are going good for people who are working. You have huge bonuses being paid out at the steel mills right now because they had record profits in the second quarter.
Right.
The Cleveland-Cliffs workers, I was still on a Sarasota middle, the Cleveland-Cliffs workers had record bonuses of like $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000, something to that effect. It was as high as, I think, like $8,000 for some of the U.S. steel workers with like the profit-sharing agreements they have in place. And then there was just news yesterday that Cleveland-Cliffs also reached its immunization targets. They set it up where they're going to pay workers $1,500 just to get vaccinated and $3,000 if at least 75% of the workers got vaccinated. And the company as a whole reached the 75% threshold. Most of the steel mills across the country, over 60% of them, I think, reached that where they're getting the full $3,000 bonus. And then that includes ArcelorMittal Indiana Harbor, which is their largest steel mill in the country. Cleveland-Cliffs Indiana Harbor, which is their largest steel mill in the country, which also have been ArcelorMittal's, and which is really two steel mills, the old LTV and Inland, kind of cobbled together. But they managed to get 75% vaccinated there, so they're going to be taking home a nice $3,000 bonus on top of the profit share bonus they just got. So it's been a real windfall for steel workers in the region lately.
Well, Joe, we'll have to come back again and talk about some other issues. And certainly we have a story that would deserve a time alone talking about the shutdown, one of the blast furnaces at the mill. That's another story that we are going to have to touch on again soon. And we thank you for spending time to bring us up to date on the stories today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Joseph Pete is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to Chesterton Tribune editor Amy LaValle, to Carol Carlson from the Post Tribune, to Times of Northwest Indiana business reporter Joseph Pete for the stories that we've covered and topics today on the program. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back with you on Monday.